I'm Jess Miles, and welcome to the Transforming Society podcast. For the top 10% of earners in the UK, wealth no longer guarantees security. They're worried about their income, are anxious about the future, especially that of their children. The gap between them and the wealthiest 1% is growing quickly, and the 10% aligning their values with those of this group, the 1%, isn't working anymore. In this episode, I'm very excited to be speaking to Jerry Mitchell and Marcos Gonzalez Hernando about their book, Uncomfortably Off, Why the Top 10% of Earners Should Care About Inequality, which delves into the mindset of this under-researched group. The book reveals that it's time for higher earners to reset their attitudes towards the lives of others and re-examine their relationship with the private sector, public services, and the state. Starting to care more about social inequality and abandoning ideas about meritocracy will be more beneficial for them than maintaining the status quo. So let's find out more. Welcome, Jerry and Marcos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Hi. Thank you.
Thank you for speaking to me today. Can we start? Can you just tell us a little bit about yourselves, your background, how you came to write this book? Marcos, do you want to go first?
Sure. So the book came out of a research project which was led by FEBS and TASC, a Irish and Brussels think tank, EU think tank, which they were interested in the attitudes of this top 10% towards inequality, redistribution, etc. Mm-hmm. And I was coordinating the project, which was carried out in four countries, Ireland, Spain, Sweden, and the UK. And Jerry was in charge of the UK chapter. So that is more or less where it comes from. And as we were writing this report, we were thinking also about how we our own positionality, our own position in society would affect in some ways how we see the subject itself and why we find it interesting. So myself, I am the son of upwardly mobile doctors from Chile originally. When I was born, we weren't part of the top 10% of the country, but as I was growing up, we increasingly were. But then I moved to the UK. I decided to do a PhD in sociology and came out and found it fairly difficult actually to make ends meet at some point. If you would know anyone actually starting academia and how difficult it is and how casualized it has become, you'll know a bit more about that. At the same time as I was actually doing this research on the top 10%, and as I was reporting and being in contact with a lot of people in the top 10%, as my own researches on it, policy elites as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jerry, how did you come to this?
Yes, I think it is quite good to introduce our backgrounds because it is so much of why we wrote the book and we're motivated to write it. And I haven't put this in the book, actually, but it is central to my interest in the impact of inequality on society in Britain. My stepfather adopted me when I was four. And my mother and my stepfather's families are very different social classes.
Okay.
So combined being the first in my mother's family to go to private school and university, together with my stepfather's higher socioeconomic grouping, in some ways I basically felt like an imposter in both both camps.
Yeah.
Which is quite a good grounding for a sociological researcher.
Yeah.
An only child, from 4 years old to about 13, I spent a lot of time behind the scenes in London's luxury hotels, like where my stepfather and mother worked. And when I wasn't back of house in hotels, going to a private school, I was a latchkey kid in the homes of some of the city's wealthiest children. I was living in Thatcher's Britain. So basically, I was really aware of inequality from a very young age. But then I also spent some of my teenage years living in Jordan in the Middle East.
Okay.
And that introduced me to inequality sort of on an international scale. So since then, my background's been a combination of public sector admin and academia. And in early 2000s, I moved to Woking, which is a town half an hour out of London in Surrey. And I had my young children and I worked locally in a special needs school and volunteered. And basically, I saw the impact of austerity on my local community, on my family. And that really drove the beginning of political involvement. And in 2019, I stood as Woking Labour's parliamentary candidate in the general election. So
I didn't know you'd done that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. All of that comes into writing the book.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And actually, what we bring to this kind of research is everything in a way, isn't it? And I think this book in particular feels like your backgrounds are very important in the context, aren't they? So let's clarify who we're actually talking about. And I think many people don't even realize that they are in the top 10% of earners, where I think we all just think we're normal and average. So who are the 10%? And what's their relationship to those wealthier and those less well off than them?
So the first thing to say is that the threshold, as in terms of personal income, to be part of the top 10%, depending on the source and the year, of course, but it's generally around or just under £60,000 a year before tax. Just to give you one example, in London, I believe the average house price at the moment is a bit over £500,000. And with earning 60K a year would mean you would definitely struggle if you don't have a pretty sizable deposit to actually get a mortgage to live in one of the cities where you're most likely to find a job that would get you into the top 10% in the first place. Yeah. So the top 10% is an incredibly varied group. But nevertheless, there are things that, on average, will bring them together, or at least we're more likely to find them there. So just to give you one example, about 80%, 80, 85% of the top 10% declare themselves to be either professionals or managers.
Okay.
But most professionals and managers are not part of the top 10%.
Yes.
In the same way that most of the top 10% will have tertiary education, university education.
Yeah.
But most people who have university education are not a top 10%.
Okay. Yep. I get
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
There are other things that bring them together. So generally when you do surveys on attitudes to whatever, say inequality, for instance, you need to group the population in like different cohorts. And one of the most common is the top 10%. So you'll find, for example, that according to these surveys, the top 10% is much more likely to believe in meritocratic explanations for their own position in society and the position of others in society as well.
Yes.
So those are the kind of things that bring them together at an aggregate level, even though they're a very diverse population, which includes people who will struggle to get a mortgage, but also billionaires. You know, there's no upper limit.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerry, did you have anything else you wanted to say about the group generally?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to repeat what was in your question, that if you don't realise you're not in the 10%, then you're not alone. I mean, that is what we found. Mm-hmm. People rarely know they're in this band.
So they don't consider themselves as particularly wealthy.
No, they don't feel rich, but they tended to call themselves privileged, but not rich. They don't feel rich. They know they're not at the very bottom, and they know they're not at the very top. I would just probably add that also the stat that we mentioned early on in the book, that 5%, so earning about 81,000, they're actually nearer the median earner at, when we wrote the book, I think it was 26,000, now it's 32,000. So they're nearer that earner than they are to the top percent, 1%, sorry, at 180,000. So they're actually nearer the median than they think they are. And they're so far away from the very top.
Yeah.
5%, so that's someone earning 81,000. So, yeah.
And we'll go on to talk about this, but it's kind of where they're aligning. It's all about where they're aligning themselves above and below. And it feels like the tendency is to align with the 1%, the very, very wealthy. And that's the thing that's not working. But that's what we'll talk about.
And another just last thing to say, this is a problem for various reasons, but you're underestimating your distance from both extremes. And you're also seeing the lives of your fellow citizens as we wrote in the book, much rosier than they actually are. And that is a problem. That is a problem.
Okay. So I think when I came to the book, and you have a quick look and you see what it's initially about, I had a big question, and it's a question that you go straight in with towards the beginning of the book. And that's why should we bother talking about this relatively privileged 10% at all? It's like, why should we care about what they think and feel when there are so many people less well off than them and people who are really struggling?
I think there are two reasons mainly that we put forward in the book. The first one has to do with their own position in society and the lack of what do you call, quoting the famous sociology, you see Wright Mills, the sociological imagination. So they, because they are part of, I mean, by definition, all MPs are part of the top 10% in terms of their salaries.
Yeah.
If you look at the people who earn over 60K a year, they'll also be at the top of the institutions that dominate our public life. Right.
Yeah.
And it says something that even that, you know, for example, I can't remember who it was, a famous MP recently. I think it was Javid, but I'm not completely 100% sure, who said that the salaries of the of MPs are basically not motivating for the best qualified people to actually want to become an MP in the first place.
Right.
So that tells you something about how this group, generally speaking, sees their own salaries and hence what they imagine the rest of society to be like when actually they earn better than 9 out of 10 people. So just in terms of the fact that the people who dominate the institutions and the public conversation, not to mention the media, not to mention think tanks, academia, etc., tend to live in a rarefied world where they don't necessarily have an awareness of where they sit in the income distribution. That's the first part, the basically wanting to prompt them to have a bit more sociological imagination, okay? To understand where they're sitting,
okay,
and how, and it's an interesting paradox in this group, which they feel quote unquote normal, and they tend to look up and think those others who earn, I don't know, double what I do are actually rich,
right?
Yeah, right. Whereas I am not; I'm just normal. At the same time, as there is a certain separation between this group and what they see as the rest. In some sense, what we argue also is that it's very common in this group to find what we call a small L liberal mentality.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean by that is basically that they tend to think of themselves as having proved themselves by virtue of their professional and economic status to have proven themselves to be responsible enough and hardworking enough to be able to, you know, be in charge of their own lives. So they're not necessarily, they don't think of themselves as a proper target of public policy. They should just be let be. And if public policy targets them, they would generally frame it as impinging on their freedoms or basically them having to pay more tax.
Yeah. And then that leads to this kind of us and them
mentality,
doesn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's the first reason.
Okay.
The second, which we could talk a bit more about later, is that society is obviously not static and things are changing. And we're arguing that even they, especially at the bottom of the top 10%, are finding harder and harder to basically reproduce the standard of living they become accustomed to.
Yeah. And I wonder, and it seems like that may well, there's a danger that that fear of falling will embed the ideas they already have,
yes,
rather than thinking more broadly about inequality and the impact of that. Jemmy, did you have anything else to say on that one?
Just sort of a more sort of pragmatic political line that we also mentioned early on in the book. We should bother with them because they have political clout.
It's the power, isn't it? Yeah.
Also, the top 5%, we quote somewhere, 1.635 million people who are more likely to vote. So than the rest of that on its own.
Yeah.
And another important point we make it at the beginning as well, is that they are the ones, as we've said, that design, regulate and operate the current systems. So they have the knowledge and the access to design better systems. So whether, you know, there's not political will at the moment, but they are actually the people, you know, among them, they are the ones that are sort of re-engineering our society. And then a point we make sort of throughout, that basically the main reason we should care about what they feel is if they don't feel things are working for them, the most privileged in society, and they are relatively rich, then this is a sign that the wider system of reward can't be working for anyone, can it?
Yeah.
That's what we're supposed to be
achieving.
Very
good and obvious point, yeah.
So we make that's a key point.
Yeah, I think the political bit, and I have a question a bit later about like participation and voting and things, but first I just wanted to go in a bit deeper, Marcus, to what you were saying about the beliefs and values. So the mm-hmm. beliefs and values they hold that are preventing them from seeing the benefits of more equality. And I think many of these ideas end up being seen as common sense, don't they? And then it becomes even harder to challenge them. So I wondered if we could just do some deconstruction of some of the particular beliefs they have that there kind of isn't really any evidence for anyway.
Yes.
There are a few you mentioned in the book about like NHS is failing because of inefficiency rather than underfunding, taxation being a bad thing, that kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, I think a lot of them stem from the fact that as we define it as the top 10% of income earners, so that would mean so by virtue of that definition, perhaps we ended up with a group that is generally characterized by the position in relation to educational credentials and occupational status, so okay. professionals and managers, as I said before. And because of how, you know, our social lives are sort of structured, I guess, very often people in these occupations will generally have as a frame of reference people who are similar to them, so they have similar educational credentials at professional and professional occupations. So that means that they will basically have that as a group that they compare themselves to on the one hand, and also that work itself will be crucial to their self-definition. And because work is crucial to the self-definition, very often we find in them a very clear preference towards meritocracy, and they generally tend to believe that their own position in society is based on how hard they work. They generally declare themselves to be privileged, but that privilege has to be, you know, justified in some way, and that is generally hard work. Across all interviews, be they the regardless of where they work, what kind of occupation they had, how old they were, most of the people that we talked to, they would basically say that they work very hard.
Yeah.
And that is associated with a view of the idea that those who aren't as high as them, at least implicitly, don't necessarily work as hard as they do. Even though there's like snippets of a bit more of an awareness that in huge parts of society, it doesn't really matter how hard they work, you're not necessarily going to do very well for yourself. So that's a very huge one. But it's connected with a certain belief in the underserving. That is particular in the UK. I mean, that appears in other countries too. But one thing that when we were doing our research in the other countries, we found particularly strongly in the UK is that you tend to have a certain belief in the UK, a certain belief in the of culture of poverty and of the underserving. In Spain, for instance, the people in the top 10% we spoke with over there were much more fatalistic about poverty.
Okay.
And about people who were less well off than them. They basically said that they were they were given a bad hand, and they were very difficult for them to get out of their situation.
Right.
And in Sweden, interestingly enough, they when we talked about those the less well off, they would generally think of they definitely translated very fast into a problem of integration into wider society. Whereas in the UK, maybe, I mean, there may be many reasons for that. I tend to think of the sort of Weberian Protestant ethic that justifies a certain way of looking at the poor as, you know, they're in thrall of a culture of poverty. And basically use education to justify their own position or their lack of interest in education.
Yeah.
Okay. Related to that, also, this top 10% generally underestimates the extent to which they rely on the state. Mm. So, for example, one of the first illustration we used in the book is a famous episode in Question Time by a fellow who basically couldn't believe that he's part of the top 5% of income earners earning over 80k a year. We argue throughout the book that this... this belief that they are normal and they work hard for their money is in some sense related to a sort of implicit belief that being taxed an income sort of a marginal income tax hike for earnings above £80,000 is much more material to their existence and much more detrimental to their existence than whatever you know, increase in welfare spending could happen from those funds.
Yeah.
Because in some sense they believe that, you know, as I said before, the small L liberal mentality means that they tend to believe that they're basically responsible for their own lives. And if you are given a handout, quote unquote, by others through the state, that's for some, that's basically they had to pay the bill for people who are underserving in the first place.
Yeah. So these are all such, this is going off the questions a bit, but they're all such ingrained beliefs, aren't they? Such deeply, deeply held cultural things that are reinforced by the media, who are also the 10%, aren't they? So you're just in kind of this, like this echo chamber loop. Do you want the 10% to read your book and go, ah, actually, yeah, I see where I am now and I see where I fit within the whole thing? How, I don't know what quite what my question is here, but how can the research in your book kind of go some way towards shifting those deeply, deeply held beliefs?
I just wanted to say that in the introduction, especially, we try to go over how difficult that line is to thread.
Yeah.
Because we are addressing the top 10%. Absolutely. The book is, in some sense, addressed to the top 10%. Obviously, anyone can read it, but as a political intervention, we would like people in that bracket to read it.
Yeah.
And in order for us to do that, I mean, the several pitfalls that we kind of try to avoid, you can be the judge of whether we succeeded or not. One of them is to be overly sympathetic to this group.
Yeah.
But we also don't want to antagonize them either.
No.
So that's a very important thread. And we try to do that through the interviews, trying to see why they think the way they do, how it makes sense in their world.
Yeah.
But this is where the appeal to sociological imagination comes.
Yeah.
Which is basically to say, on the one hand, look at what's happening around you, and on the other, looks what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I'll just add to that that one of the some of the feedback we've had recently from presenting our work is that sociologists particularly have liked how we've sort of shone a spotlight on the fact that we may in academia be good at being critical, but we're not actually that great at being critical of ourselves. So all the people that are in these positions, you know, maybe they're just they're used to looking out. Maybe they're not looking out enough, and that's one thing. But they're also not looking at themselves perhaps enough and where they sit.
And it's really hard as well, isn't it? It's like, well, when we talk about EDI and things, you have unconscious bias, and it's you have to really take time, don't you, to kind of look at yourselves and think about the big picture and how you fit. But your book seems to be a tool for people to do that in a way.
I don't think it's just an idea. This is, again, feedback we've had recently, which is really valuable. You know, it's not just ideas. So if you take meritocracies, Mark's been talking about, that has been deconstructed literally for decades. So, you know, very quick thing to say, if we look globally, it's absolutely obvious that the vast majority of those with the highest IQ scores are living in poverty. So that's one sentence. But that's not enough.
That's the evidence. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not enough. I mean, our respondents rarely, if ever, considered the fact that the majority of those in receipt of social security in Britain today are in work. In fact, the percentage of working age adults in poverty in work is at its highest since records began. But that's not going to be enough because, as Louise Ashley said to us recently, we are a deeply, she read our book and said, you know, we are a deeply conservative country. You know, there's many fears there. There's many sort of cultural things wrapped up. And, you know, it's not enough to present people with ideas. You know, we hope to take this forward and work out how it's used, but it's not enough just to present. If it had been enough, it would, you know, things would have changed many years ago. Even having experienced the pandemic, high earners still have a misconception about the extent to which they rely on and benefit from public services over the course of their lives, which Mark has talked about. And the belief is partly rational because when they need medical care, they use private hospitals. When they're worried about state education, they use private schools. They're sheltered by their work schemes for pensions, housing costs. And as Mark has said, they pay a higher percentage of their income for taxes that keep these public services running. And they think, why? But as we argue, like throughout the book, It is, and like Marcus said, in the future, it will be increasingly in their self-interest and their children's to support public services. Why? Because they gain indirectly from the state. So the hospital, where they're treated privately, will have doctors, staff who've been trained at public expense, for example. Their businesses, if they run businesses, will depend on the state for the healthcare of their employees. Mm. The public welfare system, which maintains social fabric, you know, prevents the breakdown of law and order, which, if that breaks down, they will have the most to lose from that. So, you know, many more of us benefit from this system than those who are directly targeted by it. So, yeah, that's one thing that's in our book. So buy the book if you want to read it.
And a really important point about thinking like beyond the immediate, what you're actually doing in that moment and what services you personally actually use. We mentioned like politics earlier and how this group are really likely to vote and have an interest in national politics. And that's a way that they can potentially use this power to change things. But I was really interested in when you talked in the book about how they're actually quite disengaged and hesitant to participate in like lowercase p politics, on the ground politics. And one of the reasons I was interested, because I've seen it myself in the context of the recent higher education strikes. So what do you think it is about the 10% that means they don't always use the power they have to question and challenge things more?
So there's a few things going on here. one of them is that the group as a whole tend to work in jobs that service the status quo. And we saw this particularly, which we know is a weakness of the book, that we interview people mainly from the South. But so it's the financial sector, et cetera. So many in the top 10% have jobs whose purpose is to service, support, protect the wealth of the top 1% normally. So accountants, corporate lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. But also cultural sector workers like us, you know, frankly. Yeah. And also, I don't think we've said so far, they tend to live in cities. So, you know, this is what makes living in cities, particularly the capital, attractive, you know, concentration of talent, housing's market speculation, all these things. So, in one form or another, high end has become enthralled to this economic common sense, which, you know, the centralized system, which we say that they're managing and regulating, but is basically operated and, you know, controlled at the very top by concentration of elites. So even for them, economic, social, political change is something done to them and not with them. That's part of us being so socially conservative. So basically, probably the most effective thing, and this has been said many, many times, that the wealthy have done is to persuade the middle class that they are middle class too. So that's why right at the beginning of our book, when we talk about Rob from Question Time episode, you know, tax hikes on incomes of 80 grand are actually not an attack on Middle Britain, but they're presented as that. So that's one thing. And our respondents, the reasons they gave more sort of going down several notches pragmatically, and also as part of their identity for not being part of local politics or trade unions, for example, they said they had lack of time, and that was seen as status, the status of being busy.
Interesting. That's
very important in their working lives.
Yeah.
The decline in civic engagement, full stop, is very well documented, like in America, Putnam, etc. People are wary. This is another really important point that came through. Are wary of oppositional, factionalist, populist politics. It makes them feel politically isolated. They're nostalgic for a former centre ground. This sense of being isolated and sort of almost like a fragility to it, I think, is important. And also, we have to say that it's our electoral system, so our majoritarian, as opposed to proportional system, has the largest increases in dissatisfaction with democracy. So, for example, where I live, you know, there's just no point in voting for Labour, for example.
Okay.
It's always been held by Conservatives. So if you have, if you live in a safe seat, you've got no incentive to get involved. So many of them will be living, I haven't got the exact stats, but, you know, many people interviewed are living in safe seats.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also say the whole sort of community, when we're writing a book in an austerity, a voluntary community sector, local government has been completely gutted.
Yeah.
So I think we're seeing a bit of a resurgence following the pandemic and people moving out of cities with, you know, local community action increasing. But basically, it's been absolutely cut off at the legs, you know, so there's less local councillors, etc.
Two things in relation to small P politics. And this is something that just occurred to me, to be completely honest. It is true that, as Jess says, that there's definitely a certain distance or lack of engagement or apathy, however you want to call it, with small p politics. A lot of it, as Jerry said, is to do with lack of time. But I would add that perhaps a huge reason behind that apathy towards small p politics is because a lot of members of this top 10% won't see the benefit it has to themselves. Was thinking that, you know, the more increasingly the way that you basically allow for the reproduction of the top 10%, I saw this, for instance, when I was doing my master's at the LSE, for instance, is that every activity that you do throughout your life, say extracurriculars, etc., is in some sense sort of geared towards adding it to your CV so that it will allow you to get a better position in the future. Yeah. And if that small p politics doesn't allow you to do that for yourself or your children, perhaps there's little incentive for this top 10% to do that, especially after they've been socialized to basically everything that you do and all the time you use is to basically allow for improving your CV and allowing and improving the bottom line. If that's the, that's one thing.
That says a lot about what we value as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like what kind of action we value as a society. And there's almost like maybe a fear of being seen to be too political and that not being good for like a dissenting person is not always seen as a positive thing as it should
that's
be.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it's often framed as sort of oppressive or totalitarian to be political because you're impinging on my right to just, you know, take care of my own life, I guess.
Yeah.
Just somewhere in the book, we say that this group is yet to be convinced that their take is disproportionate and that it has negative consequences for others. For example, the amount of emissions that the top 10% are responsible for. But they're also yet to be convinced that the way they seek to secure their position, which we talk about in the book, isolation, hoarding, consuming, affects their own well-being. So they don't see that connection either. And so they're thinking, oh, marginal tax increases, you know, won't sustain or improve their quality of life. They're trying to think of it very logically. But so I was saving this for conclusion, but basically our sort of our one main central point is that this common sense thinking, this individualistic thinking has served them well up to now, in reaching where they are now, but it won't help them remain there, and it certainly won't help their children get there. I just wanted to read out super quickly this Gary Young quote, because I read it while we were writing a book, and it kind of sums up where we are. A bold vision requires sufficient collective imagination for a shared sense of possibility and a set of principles that could apply to a common future. The idea that Britain stands for something more than posterity and itself. So we don't have that political culture. Like Britain as a country has sort of got its own CV, you know, we do this and that and that and that. There's no sense of, you know, togetherness, is there? That's the thing.
No.
It's still very individualistic. You
it's
know,
very individualistic, society. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really what we're trying to challenge. We're trying to challenge the meritocratic, pro-austerity, pro-insulation common sense.
Yeah.
Because and show the benefits of thinking in that more society, community way.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah. And that goes back to thinking about...
to you individually as well.
Like, exactly. So like thinking about all the networks of public services and things. And yes, you may be going to a private hospital, but what allows that private hospital to exist?
Yeah.
So I think I think surely people will listen to this podcast or read your book and kind of get the theory and understand the logic behind it and may well go, oh yeah, okay, like I can potentially see myself shifting my opinion in a different direction. But then I think when it comes down to actually taking action, I don't know, when it comes down to putting your cross by whoever you're voting for in the next general election, for example, there's a fear of it's a risk. So what would you say to convince people who may be a little bit more on the fence that it's not a risk?
So one of the critiques that we've received since the book was launched is that we tend to basically look at this top 10% and try and understand how they look at society and their own lives through their structural position, which is absolutely correct. But if it's based on their structural position, then how can we change it in the future, so to speak? How is it enough, as Jerry said before, to appeal to the embedded angels or to the rationality? Perhaps not. But to that, I would say that a very important antecedent to this book is obviously Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. And what Thomas Piketty said is, I mean, it's a massive book, very well argued, but at the core of it, a very simple argument, which is that the returns from owning are going to become and increasingly becoming much more important than the returns from work. And because this population, we decided to focus on income and not wealth, and this is probably the key reason.
Right.
They are defined through their work and through their meritocratic explanations of their own lives. Right.
Yeah.
But because we live in a Piketty world, that is going to be less and less effective as time goes on. So they basically have two options. One is to hoard and to transform as much as possible of their income into wealth. But that has several problems. One of them is that the barriers to transforming income into wealth are becoming much more onerous. We talked about mortgages on the one hand.
Yeah.
And on the other, that it defeats the whole purpose or the whole idea of meritocracy in the first place. And they, at the very least, will have to come to terms with that fact.
The planet won't allow it either. I mean, you know, the European Union and other bodies are already, you know, creating guidelines for, you know, working less per week. I mean, that's a whole different podcast, but it, you know, that we can't all keep working and consuming as we have in our, you know, earlier lives.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change does come into it, doesn't it, as well? Of
yes.
course. And it's all that, like, we published a book called The Economics of Arrival by Catherine Trebeck and Jeremy Williams. And that whole thing about slowing down and not just growing and not just having more to buy it. Yeah.
Mm, absolutely. And just in terms of climate change, one thing that I found fascinating while researching the book is that this group, I mean, whether you declare yourself or not to be worried about climate change goes up with income and education. So this group would be one of the most likely to declare themselves to be worried about climate change.
Mm.
However, they also have the largest carbon footprints.
Yeah. So why, if they're worried, if they're worried about climate change, but people don't stop flying, don't stop driving, people don't really change their behavior, even though they're worried about things. And I'm as guilty as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we all are.
Yeah.
Understand. Yeah.
I think it's the keeping up the Joneses is the status thing, which our respondents talked about, is huge.
Yeah. It comes down to, it's our priorities, isn't it? And what we really value. So kind of on one level, we kind of care about this, but we care about ourselves more, I suppose.
I think it's values, how they link to our self-esteem and our own identity. Yeah. Mm. It's very tricky questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's why one of the main metaphors we use throughout the book is the bunker.
Yes. You don't, yeah. You close down, don't look at anything too much, then you can just crack on and do your thing, can't you?
This is why we talk about spillover effects, for example. So looking at health would be a good way to think about this. So top 10% will largely think they can maintain their good health through private healthcare, you know, good nutrition, et cetera, et cetera. But studies have shown already that widespread health inequalities have spillover effects.
Okay.
So not only with the spread of infectious disease, but for example, I think it was Michael Marmot, who found that the middle classes are already losing 8 years of full and active life because of deep-seated inequality. So that'll be all those connections to people that they see as undeserving, or, you know, that actually they need, that they're interconnected with, that even if they're going to the gym, having their private healthcare, having their holidays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, that is still, there's a spillover in the, you know, at a collective level that they won't be aware of, but people like Michael Marmot, who are experts in it, will see. But it's very interesting.
It's so interesting. I need to wrap up now, really. But this is why people have to read the book and buy the book, because it's all in there and it does really make you think. So just as a last question, I don't know, it's easy to just feel like structural political change I don't think structural political change will happen anytime soon, but it doesn't mean that we can't do anything now. So what would be your final word to listeners in the 10%, especially those who may have only just realised they're in the 10%? Marcus, do you want to go first on that one?
Yeah, that one's really hard, actually. But if I had to summarize maybe is
by the book.
Yeah, by the book. That's a good one. Yeah, maybe try and take a breather. Maybe try and do that. Will obviously, as we said, the top 10% is a very, very group. You'll find different people in very different walks of life. But one thing that unites them, arguably, is an attempt to differentiate themselves from the rest of society, be it through academic credentials, be it through occupational prestige, be it through the gadgets that they buy, where they live, etc. Maybe try and do a bit less to differentiate yourself, and that will allow for a bit more sociological imagination, wherever that may be.
Yeah. Jerry.
Yeah, no, I totally absolutely agree with that. Perhaps on one sort of level down, sort of pragmatic points, particularly coming up to the next general election, is to maybe look at other countries and understand the cost of not investing. So globally, there is a clear tendency for states to become becoming more economically more proactive.
Yeah.
Particularly in terms of preparing for a sustainable climate neutral and digital economy. And if we don't make a collective investment, we will not have a resilient society and economy. And the longer that we wait, the more expensive it becomes. And it becomes more expensive for the people that are least able to afford it. So you have that vicious cycle. And probably the last word would be to think, try and think in a slightly different way about the role of tax. So I absolutely love the way Zoe Williams put it in a book of hers a few years ago, where she said, tax has unbounded potential. When something is created collectively, like the NHS, it bestows on all of us a sense of our own power. It turns us all into adventurers, as she put it. Our social contract and our democratic institutions need reviving, and we need to think of that vastness and that collective power. If you compare that to the post-purchase dissonance of buying a designer handbag, you know, you feel great. How long does that greatness last? And then it drops, because actually we are collective beings, and we need to get a sense of that vast power and energy of being resilient together. I think that would probably be. And just lastly, to look at some Advani and Summer, two great economists, look at some of their blog pieces. They're a page long, you know, or any of their podcasts. Just give you very quickly how dysfunctional our tax system is. It focuses disproportionately on income rather than assets, where of course true wealth is concentrated. So just giving you some quotes from one of their articles. In the year 2015, 2016, the average rate of tax paid by people who received £1 million in taxable income and gains was 35%, the same as someone earning 100,000. But one in four paid 45%, while another quarter paid 30%. One in 10 only paid 11%. This is on someone getting £1 million, the same as someone earning £15,000. So our entire tax system needs reforming. Read Advani and Summer. Because the tax is really the thing that gets a lot of people at the ballot box, going to your earlier question.
Yeah.
They need to take a little dig at that. You know, they can do that with their head, forget their heart and their values. Just take a quick Google of Advani and see what our current tax system, what state it's in.
So takeaways, take a breather, do less to differentiate yourself, look at what the rest of the world is doing. Think about tax, Google Advani, think about the power and energy of the collective, and develop a sociological imagination.
Wow, so lovely wrapping up. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry and Marcus. It's honestly, yes. I could talk to you all day about this. I think it's such a brilliant book. And it really feels like it's potentially like an opportunity for change, like just to kind of shift mindsets a little bit. And that's especially important at the moment. You can find out more about Uncomfortably Off, Why the Top 10% of Earners Should Care About Inequality, by Marcus Gonzalez-Hernando and Jerry Mitchell on our website, which is policy.bristoluniversitypress.co.uk. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Bye. Bye.